You're listening to the Binge Media Podcast Network on bingemedia.net. And now, the Binge Aftertaste.
Good morning.
Dr. Lecter, my name is Clarice Starling. May I speak with you?
You're one of Jack Crawford's, aren't you?
I am, yes.
May I see your credentials?
Certainly.
Closer, please. Closer.
Bon appetit, binge listeners. Pull up a chair and put on your napkin. It's time for another Binge Movie Aftertaste retrospective.
I came halfway around the world to watch you run, Clarice.
Join Garrett, Matthew, and newbie column writer Michael Garneri as they delve into the films starring Hannibal Lecter.
This is really gonna hurt.
From 1986's Manhunter all the way through 2007's Hannibal Rising, the boys will look into the cinematic adventures of the cannibal and what he has meant for film history.
What is this divine-looking amuse-bouche?
If I tell you, I'm afraid you won't even try it.
Peppering in some talk of the Mads Mikkelsen-starring TV series, Matt and Garrett ease Michael into the series slowly, as he has seen only one of the five films being discussed.
It rubs the lotion on its skin or else it gets the hose again.
So enjoy your meal, bingers, and be sure to stay for dessert. All brought to you courtesy of Binge Media.
Your involved is what you are in all of it. Now do it.
Hannibal, released February 9th, 2001, budget was $87 million, box office $351.6 million, and it was directed by Ridley Scott. A lot of money made on this movie. Was it worth it? We'll discuss that. I'm Garrett. I'm once again sitting here with the very appetizing Matthew Goudreau. What's going on, Matt?
It's going. Hope everyone had a good holiday.
And we are once again joined by Michael Garneri.
Hello.
What's up, Michael? How are you doing?
I'm doing well, just, you know, here clutching my Department of Justice snow globe and ready to get cracking on Hannibal.
Hannibal, once again, as people have been following along, this is Mike's first viewing of this movie, so we're going to get his initial thoughts of it. Matt, what do you remember about this movie? You read this book, obviously, correct?
As I mentioned at the end of our Silence of the Lambs podcast, I was super hyped to read this book after I read the Silence of the Lambs book and saw the movie. And it's worth noting that the book did not come out until 1999. So it was almost like as soon as that book was finished, they started production on the film. And Harris was pretty reluctant to do a sequel to Silence of the Lambs. But I was still super excited to read it. And then I read through the whole thing over the course of probably a day and a half, and I said to myself, what the fuck is this? And I proceeded to never read it again until last weekend. So,
when you found the Riz.
Yes, when I found the Riz.
I remember this very, very well. The whole production of this, because of Silence of the Lambs and because of, I mean, it garnered 12 Oscar nominations, something like that, something crazy.
Well, it won the big five, which was...
Yeah, won the big five. So, of course, they're going to want a sequel, but Thomas Harris is one of these guys who each and every word he writes is painful to write, so...
Just very lucrative.
Yeah, very.
Painful words, lucrative words.
Yeah. Did you read this, Mike? Did you read anything of this? Did you read the book? Did you...
No,
you haven't read it. Just to kind of go over the history here, once the Silence of the Lambs came out and it garnered just a ton of awards, you'd see Jodie Foster, you'd see Jonathan Demme on shows, and they're like, well, yeah, we'd be open to a sequel. It just all depends on Harris if he wants to write a book. So De Laurentiis, they owned the character of Hannibal, and seeing that they kind of faltered when they did Silence of the Lambs, they decided, well, since we have this, let's convince the guy to write another book, and then we'll do a movie right away. So they tell him to write the book, and the guy waits what was it, 10 years after Silence of the Lambs was published, this ended up finally getting published. And Jodie Foster and Jonathan Demme both passed. Jodie Foster is on record as saying she feels this is a betrayal of the character of Clarice.
Jonathan Demme said he thought it was too violent and too vulgar.
He found it too lurid, was the word I heard. And then Anthony Hopkins gives an interview saying, yeah, I've retired from acting. I'm done with acting.
When did he say that?
I think it was like 98, maybe. 98, 99, something like that.
Isn't that when he did like Mission Impossible 2?
He did say, I was watching making of documentary. He was quoted as saying it somewhere. He's like, I'm sick of acting. I'm sick of the people here in Hollywood. I'm done.
Well, I don't doubt that he is sick of acting. That might very well be true, but.
Well, he was very upset when Jodie Foster said she wasn't coming back.
He was extremely upset at that. They convinced Anthony Hopkins to come back. De Laurentiis did say that we could live with one or the other, but one thing's for sure, that this wouldn't be a movie without Anthony Hopkins. So they offered him, I believe it was upwards of $15 to $20 million to come back.
I have here $20 million.
And he came back. And then the list of actresses they wanted for Clarice was interesting. I heard Angelina Jolie being bandied around. Ashley Judd was considered. One name that I was really curious about that I would have actually liked to have seen was Claire Danes. But Hopkins had worked with Julianne Moore on Surviving Picasso, and he recommended her, and Ridley Scott saw her, and they decided that's our girl. So it should also be said that Ridley Scott at this point also had a lot of cachet. He had done Gladiator, won a ton of awards. Why?
Yes,
I don't know if we'll ever know why.
He made all the money in the world. Well,
yeah.
That was not intentional, but then
I still don't get the love for that movie.
What a fantastic tie-in. Like, that was brilliant, by the way.
I just saw it today. So I saw two Ridley Scott films today. So I guess they're both on my mind.
Made a lot of money and it won a lot of Oscars. So Demme passed. They went to Ridley Scott, who also had objections to the material. David Mamet did a script that supposedly is not very good. So Ridley Scott said, well, you better bring somebody in to polish this up. And they brought in Steve Zaillian, who did a pretty big polish on it. And after that draft was done, Ridley Scott said yes. And so we have our movie.
Should I just drop a little tidbit that I thought was funny?
Go.
Dino De Laurentiis visited Ridley Scott on the set of Gladiator, and he approached him about directing it. Now, Ridley Scott apparently thought he was talking about the historical General Hannibal. And he was quoted as saying, basically, Dino, I'm doing a Roman epic right now. I don't want to do elephants coming over the Alps next.
That's great. So we have our movie. Oscar-winning director at the helm. Oscar-nominated actress. Oscar-winning actor. Oscar-winning screenwriter. I mean, this thing couldn't go wrong, right? There's no way this movie could go wrong.
Well, what you were saying about the development of the book, it reminds me a lot of what happened with Michael Crichton in The Lost World, where they went to him and said, hey, do you want to do a sequel? And he was like, all right. And they had to hand over some money to do it, but he did it.
We open up with the injection of Barney, the character of Barney that we've seen in the last couple films, just to pretty much say he's here, right? I mean, here's a character we're familiar with. It's nice to see his face, but it's not really nice to see the face of Gary Oldman as Mason Verger, who we are, that's basically the face we open up on. And what an interesting makeup job, huh?
5 hours of makeup.
Really, really effective. I would never have guessed it was Gary Oldman. I mean, I knew ahead of time, but it's just really grotesque, very good stuff. And it does not impede his acting, which is par for the course for Gary Oldman, because he's one of those actors who does so very well under makeup and strange costumes and everything like that. Really allows it to not hinder him.
Yeah, and that was a part that was originally offered to Christopher Reeve.
Yeah, I read that, which is just insulting. Reeve actually wasn't even aware of the book, and he initially was interested, and then once he started reading the script, he's like, yeah, I think I'm going to pass on this. But Gary Oldman, interesting thing about Gary Oldman was he wanted prominent credit. He wanted to be up there next to Hopkins and Moore up in the credits. Martha De Laurentiis was adamant against it. He's like, well, those are our two main stars. And Gary Oldman's like, fine, I'll get out of the project. That's one thing I loved about Gary Oldman around this time. He was so crazy. Like, he did shit like this all the fucking time. And
yeah, he did it on the Contender too, is another movie, I think. I'm remembering correctly, he's not credited on that, and he's like all over that movie. And not under a weird prosthetic.
Yeah. I mean, he did this shit all the time. So finally they lured him back and he said, okay, I'll go ahead and do it, but I don't want any credit anymore. So he comes into this movie unbilled, although he does get a credit at the end of the movie. So Barney's pretty much rehashing Silence, getting us re-familiar with the character and saying Starling woke Lecter up from his stoicness and gives Verger the mask, sells it for $250,000. Wow. Is there really a market for shit like this? I guess there is, huh? Serial killer stuff.
Yeah, he's got it right next to the puzzle box from Hellraiser and Freddy Krueger's glove.
Yeah, right.
I thought it was nice tone setting. It's a nice little creepy kind of little scene with this sort of slow build. It's done in an interesting way where a couple titles come on, like the studio titles, and then there's what would appear I'm trying to describe it. I don't know if I really have the vocabulary for this. But basically, it appears in a tiny form and slowly we're brought into the scene in progress. And it's a neat little way to introduce it. And I was like, okay, let's see where you go with this, Scott. And it was very different from anything that Demme was doing in Silence, which I think is the case for a lot of these, or for a lot of this film. And that's going to be something that I guess we're going to talk about probably a lot.
That's the microcosm for the entire movie. This movie is the complete opposite of Silence of the Lambs in a lot of ways.
We cut to the Hannibal title card and some really weird credits here, inspired obviously by Seven. We end with pigeons forming Lecter's face, which, oof.
Yeah, no. I thought that was kind of silly.
We cut to Moore playing Clarice Starling, and she gives a monologue about a new suspect they're going after, and they go to a shootout, and we see some really Scott action that I'm not too excited about.
Well, generic.
Very generic.
He should have gotten his brother.
His brother would have done a great job with this action. You know, Mike, you mentioned last week when I asked you, what to expect. You mentioned that, it's a really Scott movie, so I expect a lot of great production values. And I had to work really hard to bite my tongue because I would say of all his oeuvre, this is probably one of the most boring shot movies of Ridley Scott's career.
Yeah, it's surprisingly pedestrian in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what was happening here. I think even when his movies are bad, and he has made some not very good movies, there's a lushness and an expansiveness and the sets and stuff and the costuming. I think he puts a lot of concern into that and a lot of care into the sort of having the world feel livable in a way, and not just livable, but also you want to step in and see it. There are parts where you get that here, a lot of the stuff in Florence, but the way he films it is just kind of pedestrian, unfortunately.
I wonder if this was one of those projects he did for the money, because this came out the same year as Black Hawk Down, and you could tell that was a real passion project.
Yeah, yeah.
This kind of seems like it was, again, the Spielberg analogy reminds me of Lost World, which he was filming something else at the time, and you could see that's kind of one of Ridley Scott's problems, I think, is that he sometimes has too much on his plate when it comes to the projects he attaches himself to, and this was this is the first sequel he had ever done. And I think this and Alien Covenant, I think, are the only two. So I wonder if the fact that it wasn't his original property had to do with him. I mean, it's a competently directed movie. I don't think it's not technically bad in a lot of aspects with cinematography or anything like that. It just, it's just a weird.
Yeah, it lacks that precision of Silence of the Lambs that made that so great, where it didn't feel like there was a single wasted shot or a wasted moment. Or anything like that. It was subtle. It was, the composition was good. Here, it felt kind of not like he didn't really know what he was going for in every scene.
Yeah, it's really pedestrian.
So we've gone over Ridley Scott a little bit. How do we feel about Julianne Moore here? She's taken over some really big shoes of Jodie Foster in this role of Clarice Starling. This is our intro to her. How are we feeling about Clarice, our new Clarice?
Well, I love Julianne Moore, and I think that if you're going to get, and I talked last week about how much I love Jodie Foster as Clarice and how great of a performance I thought that was. And I think it's really unfortunate that Jodie Foster didn't want to do the movie, but if you're going to replace her with somebody, I think Julianne Moore is probably about as good of an option you're going to get. I think she does well with what she has here, but I was quite disappointed by how Clarice was written this time. But that's not on her, right? That's on the writing.
My issue is her accent feels much more of an like an affectation than Jodie Foster's did.
I spotted that as well, and her Dr. Lecter isn't as strong. I figured maybe 10 years on, she's a little bit more homogenized.
Which is weird, because isn't Julianne Moore herself from like South Carolina or something? Like she should be able to turn that accent on pretty quick.
Let me see.
Well, Foster's accent is very specific.
North Carolina, yeah. What's that, Matt?
Well, Foster's accent in Silence of the Lambs, that's a very specific dialect.
Uh-huh.
And I wonder how much she had to work to try to replicate that. And for me, it doesn't work. I mean, I don't think it's Julianne Moore's fault, because I think she's one of the best actresses we have. But I think it's one of the problems with this movie is that I feel like it doesn't work. Jodie Foster is Clarice Starling. And we'll see that later on, where I felt like, and this is me kind of talking from hindsight, to where you either get Hopkins and Foster, or you completely reboot and get two new actors, because the chemistry is one of the most important parts of Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah.
And granted, Clarice in this is very detached from Lecter for quite some time in this movie, so they're fortunate in that regard, but there's just a lot of... It stems from my biggest problem with this movie, is that the source material is not up to par. And there's a lot of stuff in this book that just doesn't work. But I think Moore is... I don't know. It's just the accent really... It hurts my ears.
Well, Mike put it into context for me. I was all set to rip into Moore, because when she's in these action scenes, she's fine. I don't like when she has to like yell during meetings and things. She doesn't really have a really strong presence, like when she's yelling at Grindler later on. And when I talk to you, you will know it because I will look your way. That kind of stuff. Like, I don't really go with that kind of stuff. But she's fine. But I think Mike hit it. Like, I don't really think it's Moore's fault. I just think it's the way the girl's written. Because let's face it, this is a real mopey Clarice Starling. She spends a lot of this movie moping and listening to tapes and spending time in basements and far away from the action. And that's not Moore's fault. So I can't really be as ostentatious towards her as I was intending to be. So this girl that they're going after, Matt, wasn't she a bigger player in the book, this druggie? I seem to remember this going on a little longer.
Yeah, well, they mentioned in the book the big thing is that she's like a transsexual. She has AIDS, so that's why Clarice has that line about make sure she doesn't, if she stabs you with a needle or something, watch out. So that's played up a little bit more in the book. But when you're talking about a book that's over 500 pages, and there's a lot of stuff in that book, it's about as much, maybe just a little bit more in the book compared to the film.
And as we touched on, I think this scene is pretty tame by Scott standards. I mean, what do we see? We see a few Coke cans get shot up and some fruit go everywhere, but this is just a pretty boring, and you guys put it perfectly, pedestrian action scene. You know, a car backing into a few bodies. Okay, that's kind of, you know, it's kind of interesting, but that's about it. I'm not exhilarated by this at all.
No, well, it's also kind of an odd, there's a weird sort of thing going on in this movie where a lot of the Julianne Moore, Clarice stuff is kind of boilerplate sort of cop thriller kind of stuff, you know, a lot of turn in your gun and badge sort of thing.
Yeah.
And then Anthony Hopkins is off in this strange, surreal, like horror film with like pigs eating people and brains getting ripped off. And it just doesn't coalesce really in the way that it should.
A lot of the meat for Clarice's story and a lot of the context is completely removed from this movie. So we don't really get to live in her skin as much as we do in the book.
Or as much as in Silence of the Lambs. And Scott's camera is not as empathetic as Jimmy's camera was in that film.
Yeah, he definitely doesn't use as many close-ups.
Starling shoots Esmeralda, and man, does Scott linger on that slow-mo. Fuck, does he use slow-mo a lot in this scene?
He uses a lot here. It's a very strange choice. And not just slow-mo, but that slow motion, but it's also, they're like removing frames for individual frames from it, so it has that jerky quality to it.
Yes.
You know what I'm talking about? There's lots of that. I should know what that's called. That's embarrassing.
I hate that stuff, too. I really don't like that style of action.
Just from a directing standpoint, I don't understand why you put that in for a character who has no significance up to this point. They play it like this is some kind of escalation of something we'd seen beforehand. And it sets up the plot, but she's just a MacGuffin to get Clarice off the force.
We meet Paul Krenler, played by Ray Liotta, the actor who played Paul Krenler in Silence of the Lambs. He actually passed away in between these two films being made, so they picked up Ray Liotta, and
he was in Silence of the Lambs.
He very, very briefly.
He's in the scene when Lecter meets the senator.
Yes.
So he's just like a minor. Okay.
Very minor. Yeah.
Got it.
Very minor. Ray Liotta, who is the definition of sleaze, right? I mean, even when he was in Goodfellas, even then, like, he was still like a bad guy, you know?
So, oh, he was still a misogynist.
What do you mean even in Goodfellas? Like, even in Field of Dreams, he's a bad guy. And that's Field of Dreams.
That's true.
I mean, he got his big break playing a psychopath in Something Wild.
Another Demi joint. And what is this, a hearing about her job? So she rescues this baby, but there's a hearing about her job?
Well, because she shot a woman who was carrying a baby.
Okay.
The big thing that is not in this movie is that Krenler's whole motivation is that he is purposefully blackballing Starling because he felt that he should have gotten more of the credit for taking down Lecter and Silence of the Lambs. And that he was kind of passed over by Jack Crawford. So he pulled some strings to keep her out of behavioral sciences, which is what she was going for in the first place. So that's why
Krenler, she's in drug bust.
Yeah, well, that's why Krenler and the higher-ups have her doing more of the routine bureau stuff, like search warrants and like general surveillance. So they're purposely blackballing her because he's a misogynistic prick.
As Starling here stating her case, I'm just going to go ahead and go back to Moore. Some points I think she's okay, but I'm having a real hard time buying her in this role. Basically because Foster kind of exuded this confidence and stoicism. I don't like Moore when she's snapping at people, and I don't like Moore when she has to exude that stoicism that Foster did so well in that last film. To put it bruntly, it feels like Moore is acting, where Foster always looked like it was kind of natural.
Well, I like how Jodie Foster, one thing that she does in her performance, and part of this is the writing, is that when she goes out on her own and makes decisions on her own, she has a confidence to her. Moore always seems like she's being very defensive about whatever she does.
Great way of putting it.
Well, she starts off on the defensive from the beginning of the film. It's an interesting point about that.
And one minor detail is that the group that gets the pictures of the shootout is the Tattler, which is what used to employ Freddie Lowndes.
Oh, yeah.
But we don't know who Freddie Lowndes is right now.
Well, he's dead.
Right, but we haven't seen Manhunter because we're a 2001 audience and the Michael Mann renaissance hasn't come around yet.
Unless you're one of those Michael Mann diehards or book snobs.
Yeah.
Like, there was one movie, goddammit.
Starling makes her way to Verger, and this is setting up a bit of intrigue about Mason's past and how he got decimated by Lecter after a night of fun. I really do like, and we kind of ripped on the way Scott shot this film, but I do like how Mason's lit here.
Yeah, very well done.
Yeah.
I like the dreamlike state that it shot.
Oh, yeah.
The theatrical quality to the lighting is really very fake, but very good. You know?
Yeah, absolutely. It's you can't say it's not beautiful to look at. I mean, the scene of Verger, like, losing his face, it seems overwrought and drawn out for its own good, but it's still, like, it's beautifully lit. So I don't have any real knocks against this scene. It's a good setup for this character, too.
Although they left out a lot of stuff for the context of why Verger was seeing Lecter.
They basically imply that he's a child molester and that he was recommend. I don't know.
Yeah.
Basically, they were having this great psychologist check him out, and I guess he was getting a slap on the wrist because he was rich.
Yeah, it's expanded upon the book because they mentioned that at one point he operated a Christian camp, which he talks about like kids, I'll do anything for a candy bar. He molests all the kids that go there. And the big omission is that his twin sister is not in this movie at all.
Yeah.
He raped her as a teenager and she went to go see Lecter as therapy. And Lecter put in her head, your therapy should be to kill your brother. He eventually gets arrested for the molestation. But because his family is so politically powerful, he gets kind of a slap on the wrist, like you were saying. And then Lecter weaves his way into being his psychiatrist that the court installs on him. So in the book, there's a lot more context as to how he met Lecter in the first place.
Some of this I picked up on in second and third season of the show, which kind of redoes a lot of this, but in very different ways.
Yeah, I'll be talking about the show at the end of this podcast. I have some things to say about it because I've started watching it.
All right.
Talk about that at the end. So Starling is going over all of Lecter's files, including a video of Lecter completely biting some nurse's face off. That was rather disturbing and something I had completely forgot about.
I think that was the footage of the picture that Barney shows her in, or Barney or Chilton shows her in Silence of the Lambs.
That's kind of what I was thinking too. I think that was the association.
Where his pulse never got over
85.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mike remembers these things, Matt. He has a good memory. This Mike.
Yeah, like a steel fucking trap.
It helps that you've seen him recently.
we should keep him around, this guy. Barney gets visited by Starling, who gets interrogated about assets that Barney has sold and what else he has about Lecter. Is Barney in the book? He's not in the book, is he?
No, he's in the book because he connects to the twin sister.
Oh, that's right.
They mentioned in the book that he keeps going back and forth through Lecter's cell and getting all the paraphernalia to sell.
Okay. Now, one bit about this movie I do like. They were saying, like, look, we don't really need Starling in this movie because we have Potsy here in Florence, Italy, and he gets on the tail of Lecter.
Makes it sound like the guy from like Third Banana on Happy Days. Like Potsy. Well,
there's a reference and a half.
Yeah. Who's the guy? Not Ralph Mouth, but Potsy. If Ralph Mouth was in this movie too, though, that'd be pretty good.
I could have been okay with us just chasing Potsy and Lecter around Italy this entire film. I like this part of the story.
I was oddly more into this than a lot of the Clarice stuff.
Absolutely. And I think the only reason we got a lot of the Clarice stuff is because of Silence of the Lambs. Remember, we went from Manhunter to Silence of the Lambs. We went from Will Graham to Clarice Starling. I think if Silence of the Lambs hadn't come out and been the success that it was, we could have had a whole new character and done the exact... Harris would have played these beats with a different character and it would have worked fine. But we need the sequel to Starling and Lecter's relationship, right? So that's why he had to interject Starling into this story. But I'm looking at this Potsy stuff and I'm thinking, you know what? Fuck all that stuff with Starling. Let's stay here.
Yeah, it's weird. I almost could have, like, if they had made two movies and one of them was The Further Adventures of Clarice Starling and Hannibal Never Appeared, and another one was On the Hunt for Hannibal and Clarice Never Appeared, I would think that would have worked out best, honestly.
I'd be more accepting of it if they played up... One of the things I do really like about the book is that they play up a lot of Potsy's morality. And in the movie, it's just the only sense you get is that he's kind of... He feels down and out with how he's being treated on the police force, and that's why he does the things he does. But I like how in the book, Harris does probably about 20, 25 chapters of just Potsy stuff and him being on the run of capturing Lecter. But I do think this is, from a storytelling perspective, this is the strongest part of the movie. Although there's something that happens that I really don't like that we'll talk about later.
You know, I talked earlier about having different tones and how they sometimes clash. I think there's a neat kind of like a procedural kind of dark, but not to the gothic degree of some of the Verger stuff, thriller qualities with the Florence and Potsy plot lines here that I think Scott really digs into in a way that I think works. Like that's where that precision comes back in that for a lot of this film I don't get a sense of, but that I did get in Silence of the Lambs.
Yes. A great reintroductory shot of Hopkins as Lecter as he turns around and is looking rather classy in his hat. One thing I do remember from the book, Matt, is that in the book, Lecter has had plastic surgery, right? So he doesn't look like the way he is.
Yes. That, and also he has polydactyl in the book, so he cuts off, he has one of his extra fingers removed. As another piece of hiding, which, if they stuck with that, could have been a way to recast it, and no one would have said anything.
That's what I was about ready to say. I mean, they were. If Hopkins had said no, they had Tim Roth all set to play Lecter.
Oh, I could totally see that.
I could too. I definitely could see that.
Especially if you've seen the show Lie to Me, which he was on for a couple years. I could totally see that. And another name, which would have been batshit crazy, but that would have gone well with this movie, was Malkovich.
Yes. Yes, I read that as well.
He has a good malevolent presence to him, and he's got big expressive eyes, which is good. Yeah, it's kind of weird for this film in the way that it's both kind of a direct sequel and a loose sequel, that if they had done that, if they had a complete recast with Jodie Foster out, Julianne Moore in, Jonathan Demme out, Ridley Scott in, Anthony Hopkins out and then Tim Roth or whoever in. I don't know how I would have felt about that, if that would have strengthened it or not. I mean, like, it seems like kind of counterintuitive to like take out Anthony Hopkins because he's so I mean, he's just so indelible in this role. But there is just a strange kind of detached quality to this film where Julianne Moore is listening to these tapes of what we heard in Silence of the Lambs, but it doesn't. When we heard it in Silence of the Lambs, it was with Jodie Foster. So we're like, what's going on here? So I don't know. I mean, Tim Roth could have done it, of course.
It would definitely take some restructuring. But I think because Manhunter and Silence of the Lambs are so radically different as far as casting and as far as directorial approach, I think they totally could have done it for this movie. But because Hannibal Lecter had become such a big pop culture icon, he's all over this movie, and
the
trailer was sold on his voice, which you hear on the phone. But this was a bad year for Tim Roth, because not only was he not able to play Hannibal Lecter, he turned down Harry Potter to do Tim Burton's Planet of the Apes.
He's a little old for Harry Potter, though. I mean,
I can totally see that. I can totally see that.
They could do like a CGI thing, like put his head on like a kid's body.
We don't need any more Uncanny Valley Tarkin bullshit.
Yeah. As Snape, right?
Yeah, he was going to play Snape.
Clarice opens a letter from Lecter, and it is here where I just don't feel any of the chemistry that Hopkins and Foster had. I mean, how can you get that, right? But I'm not liking this letter, although I do like the picture of Lecter on the FBI website, which is located right near Osama bin Laden.
And Wade Bulger.
Yeah, I know it's sad.
Yeah, don't forget, this was like, what was this, about 8-9 months right before 9/11, too. So he was already wanted by the FBI around this time.
And the letter is almost verbatim from the book.
Yeah.
The only difference is that Jack Crawford's mentioned.
Huh.
And he's mentioned a lot more in the book than he is in the movie, which is not at all.
Is he in the book? Like, does he make an appearance?
He doesn't, but he's mentioned that he's detached from Clarice and he's not really with the Bureau. And they reveal at the end of the book he's died.
Okay, interesting. There was an offer out to Scott Glenn, and he was like, I'm too busy doing Scott Glenn things.
Meanwhile, Potsy gets a tape of Lecter in a jewelry store and eventually gets right on his trail, right? How are you guys liking this procedural stuff? Which, you know, it was very, very gripping last time, all the procedural stuff. We all agreed that. But do you feel like it weighs the film down, or are you guys going along with this?
This is my favorite part of the movie.
I think it's the most effective.
Albeit, you have to get past the suspension of disbelief that nobody would recognize Hannibal Lecter.
Yeah, that's one of those things you just have to, it's like Clark Kent with the glasses.
The glasses.
You have to accept it. But like, what the hell is he doing? Like going out trying to become a curator of, you know, Dante and literature here. It's like, you didn't see Bin Laden doing that. You know what I mean? Like,
Bin Laden was at the jewelry store. He was at the deli across the street.
Yeah. Yeah, the other people in, you know, Bin Laden and Whitey Bulger were not trying to get professorships while they were, you know, fugitives from justice. It really doesn't make any sense, but you just kind of have to roll with it.
Potsy pays a kid to go for Lecter's wallet. I do love that by the end of the day, Lecter knew all along, right? He's the smart guy who always knows. And now you guys said that this is like your favorite part. You guys like this procedural stuff. It's your favorite part. I think the tension here is really well done. I think Scott still knows how to build the tension. And again, I think this part in the book, I think this, I remember the book. I read it when it first came out, but I remember this being just really, really, really long in the book. I mean, I think that this is like 300 pages of that book, isn't it, Matt?
I'd say it's about half.
Yeah.
Maybe a little bit less, but it's a long book.
It's 500-600 pages. So Lecter cuts the kid. And we cut to Verger making a call to a guy named Carlo about feeding the boys, as he calls them. And we see the pigs for the first time. Don't forget, too, like when Potsy goes to the fountain. Did you guys notice what that fountain was? It was a pig.
A lamb. Oh.
It was a pig, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a pig.
Oh, that makes sense.
More on the no stuff, right, Matt? At this point in the movie, I'm feeling weird because I literally have no idea who we are supposed to be rooting for. Is it Verger trying to extract his revenge? Starling for trying to get her life in order? I don't know, but I think for some bizarre reason that Harris and Scott are trying to ask us to sympathize with Lecter.
You're 100% right, they are. This is a film where clearly the filmmakers sort of fell in love with the character of Hannibal Lecter and sort of refocused the movie around him. I mean, the opening of the movie is literally birds forming his head and then flying off, and we're supposed to evidently stand up and applaud. I don't know. I mean, the film's named after him. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's Hannibal, and it's even... it's just a little too much, I think. It's just, like, to have him as the star of the movie, you know, have the Hannibal Lecter movie. Hannibal's big deal.
Yeah. That's my biggest problem with the movie, is that what worked so well about Silence of the Lambs is that Lecter was kept in the shadows. He was a menace. He was threatening. When you put him out in the open, there's no suspense. Except for that chase scene with Potsy and that boy trying to take his wallet. And we haven't talked much about Hopkins. I think this is where we start to get into the scenery-chewing Hannibal Lecter, literally, in a couple of ways. I think he's starting to become a caricature. And that's one of my problems. That's one of my problems with this movie. And I think it shows that you can have too much of a good thing. But as far as him being the hero of this piece, I think that would be true, except they cut his backstory, which is in the book, from the movie, which really tries to create empathy for him in the book. And that's not in this movie.
Yeah, you're right. But I think that it's less about the empathy and more about how often we're supposed to be like, "Whoa, man, how cool," whenever he does stuff in this movie. I think and you talk about sort of having too much of a good thing. I think they overload him with, they like kind of a little overboard with like the, let's make him the high class serial killer, which is like, that's kind of his whole thing. But like when he's, you know, playing concertos on the piano and like lecturing on Dante and stuff, like, it's like, are you a psychologist? Like, or a psychiatrist? Well, like, you know, how many master's degrees did you get?
You need the Dante stuff because that payoff is at the end of the movie, and it's actually a really, really cool callback.
Oh, it's pretty good. It's pretty good. Don't get me wrong, but it's just sort of like...
He's literally a fountain of knowledge.
Yeah, right.
But this is a man who spent most of a great deal of time in prison, and all he had was his books.
That's true.
So he is a very well-read intellectual.
One thing I did like, one nice touch I did like, is that he said at least twice in this movie, "Okie dokie," which I thought was a nice little proletarian touch to him.
Yeah, like, I agree.
Or like, and he mentions in this film that he's not originally from America, which is was not brought up in any of the prior films, and is not in his accent either. But like, that's I kind of like that as a touch of like, this is some Americanism that he latched onto like 50 years ago and hasn't let go of or something. I don't know. I like that.
Lecter tells Patsy's wife that he's enjoyed many various meals in New England. These exchanges between Lecter and Patsy's wife, I think they're glorious. And I think, you know, there's a part later on when Lecter actually captures Patsy, just to kind of jump a little bit, and he says, "I want to enjoy eating your wife." Like, that's just... I tell you, man, and they fucking drop it, which is a total mistake. But every once in a while, we get not the scene-chewing Lecter, but the actual menacing Lecter. And I wanted more of that in this. And they just completely fucking drop that. We don't see his wife for the rest of the movie. We don't see anything for the rest of the movie. These little tiny hints of brilliance are just completely dropped, and I don't like that. Starling pulls up files of emails from France, and she warns Potsy to just kind of stay away from Lecter. Again, Scott's detailing some slow-mo to decorate his vision.
How great are the 2001 America Online moments? No,
well, the only thing we needed was the dial-up sound.
I know, right? How great would that be? Like, there's like this like great, like, you know, Verdi overture playing and stuff like that, and like the strings are rising and the coursing, and then you just...
I would have watched Julianne Moore staring at her computer with those three little windows of like the guy running and the slope. I would have watched that.
Or like the screensaver's playing and it's that weird maze, like, you know, that weird... And Anthony Hopkins is like, "Yes, the maze." And he like builds a maze to trap Gary Oldman, and I would watch that.
And then David Bowie shows up.
Yeah, yeah. See, there's all kinds of... What we're saying is, listen, Dino, get us on the phone. We got lots of ideas here.
Or Martha.
We'd have to make Dino's that call gone. The grave.
Oh. Yeah.
We'll have to talk to Martha because Dino's gone.
Martha, call us.
Yeah.
Why did you say that name?
Lecter's giving a lecture about ancient art. and here is visited once again by Potsy. I love how we know that Lecter's on his trail, but Potsy himself is just completely ignorant and thinks he's going to get the wanted money from the FBI. It's setting up some great, great tension as Potsy calls Carlo, and all the stories are finally starting to intersect. How are you guys feeling about how you know all this is starting to intersect? I mean, we have Verger's men down there, and we have the FBI on the phone. We have Potsy here, and Lecter knows that it's all being orchestrated.
I don't know. I felt the pacing in this movie is kind of off. It should be really tense and gripping, but for some reason, I felt some slack, if that makes sense. I don't know why, actually.
Yeah, well, there's some bloat in the runtime. Even with a good chunk of the book that they omitted, it still runs a little long.
He puts Potsy on this rolling wheelchair-like thing, and we also get the first conversation with Starling and Lecter on the phone, which pretty much means nothing. Lecter fillets Potsy, just like how the art was. It's rather grisly, but also, isn't it pretty cartoonish the way these innards just kind of splat on the floor here?
This whole, from here on out, the movie is very Grand Guignol, and I feel like if another director had done these scenes, I think they would have pulled back or really upped it, because it doesn't play for camp, really. A lot of the, honestly, you want to know the perfect person to do this was Brian De Palma. Because, like, you look at, like, Raising Kane, that is so Grand Guignol and melodramatic. It would have fit a lot more. Even someone like David Cronenberg, who loves, like, bodily fluids, and I think he could have had some fun with the violence. But I feel like by trying to play it so downtrodden and matter-of-fact, it doesn't work.
Well, not to keep going back to the show, but I'm going to keep going back to the show. And this is the kind of thing that they do show in the show. But if it was on the show, it would be a lot more kind of blatantly artificial in a way that would be as much to about appreciating it as it was would be about the plot in a way that make if that makes sense. You know, it would be really dreamlike, and it would have a much more surreal bent to it in a way that works to that show's credit. That show is so detached from the norms of reality, and it's anything but pedestrian, which is just interesting in comparison to some of the other films or some of the films in this series.
Lecter, I don't know. I like I said, it's just this violence here. While in Silence of the Lambs, it felt when you had the guy on the cage, obviously that was way over the top. But it's just way too cartoonish for all the stuff that Scott was saying about. You know, I don't like the source material. He's pulling back, I think, a little too much. And you guys are right when it comes to Lecter being out here in the open. He takes care of one of Verger's men with a scalpel, and even more slow-mo in this scene. But, like, is it really menacing to see Lecter wielding a scalpel, or is he more menacing from behind a cage and behind his mask?
Yeah.
And when he takes care of those guys in that cage and that Silence of the Lambs, it's menacing as hell, and it's scary. Yeah.
Well, and it's less scary. I mean, there's something about him being so terrifying with just his intellect, or you know what I mean? Like, and then if you let him out, it can be dangerous and stuff, but there's something about him just kind of being, you know, Jason or Michael Myers that doesn't really... it's also kind of just like on a physical level sort of doesn't work all that well, where Anthony Hopkins, who's at this point in his 60s and has never been a very big man, is like cracking necks and like, you know... Like,
it's like they made him the Joker almost.
Yeah. It's something a little, comic book about it.
I don't know if it's the source material, but it certainly feels like Scott is on autopilot. I don't think he even remotely believes in this story. And it's just kind of filming it this way just to kind of get it done, because there are absolutely no scenes that reflect his visual style. There's no scares. A little bit of built-up tension with Potsy, but now that's gone. I'm feeling lost at this point.
Yep.
Somewhere in between all this, Verger's trying on Lecter's mask, and he continues to formulate his plan, his revenge plan, and Krenler gets on the line with Verger, and we just knew that he was slimy just because of how he was played by Leota.
Yep, who is, I gotta say, pretty delightfully scummy here.
Absolutely. Yeah, I like the Yola in this movie a lot. Starling goes to her superiors about Krenler being dirty and on Verger's payroll, but they just shrug it off, and we just need this woman as handcuffed as possible to force her to stay away from Lecter as long as they can make her do so. I mean, that's just, all of this is just convoluted, right? They're just trying to keep her away from him as much as they can, because when they do finally get together, it's going to be that big payoff.
Well, it's, you know, it's that movie contrivance of, like, where everybody except the protagonist is either, gets either really stupid or really just malevolent in a way that doesn't, I don't think, tracks really with the way that the FBI is shown in Silence, where there are assholes in the FBI and there are obstruction and structural problems and stuff like that, but you still have Jack Crawford being very competent and very intelligent and very capable. It feels more like a kind of poorly written movie version of that.
In the book, when you find out that Krenler is in cahoots with Mason, he purposefully plants evidence and gets her on obstruction of justice, which leads them to Clarice being permanently fired from the FBI. So when she comes back into the movie and goes after Lecter, it's completely on her own accord. And that's lost in translation.
Yeah, because here she's just suspended, right?
Yeah, she's on leave.
Uh-huh. And once again, she's listening to fucking tapes of her and Lecter with her accent replacing Jodie Foster's accent in these tapes. And every once in a while, they get Hopkins from Silence, but sometimes it's all re-recorded stuff. Why isn't this chick doing anything?
If this took place 15 years later, she would be doing a podcast about this.
Foster was right, man. This is a complete fucking betrayal of that character.
Well, just it gets complete. Worse. It gets worse.
Well, it does get worse, yeah. Yes. But I'm just saying, you know what? The character we knew from the last movie just would not be doing this. But you're right. It gets way worse. I guess I should save that.
She's much more proactive than Silence of the Lambs. Here, she waits for shit to happen to her.
Yep. It hit me like when there was like 5 or 10 minutes left to go in the movie, and I was like, she really isn't done very much. Like, I was like, she just kind of... It sort of seems like she does, but she doesn't. Like, they position her as heroic or whatever, but she's just kind of sitting at home and, like, listening to tapes. Like, I've done that. I'm not heroic.
You're in my eyes, Mike.
Oh, thanks.
I do like, there are bits of dabbles of suspense. Like, Scott has Lecter go in on Starling as she's sleeping and just kind of slips out. We get the quintessential Ridley Scott ceiling fan.
Dude loves his ceiling fans.
Oh, he loves those. He loves those things, man. Films in every one of his movies. She gets called by Lecter again, and we have a phone call between the two of them where, once again, Lecter rules the roost. Not really sure how I like this conversation, as Lecter really just kind of comes off as more lecherous and menacing. He's talking about her feet and is making fun of her career.
I don't know. I didn't. Now, as we're talking, I'm disliking this movie more.
I don't even like how Lecter's like moving his hand through her hair from the carousel.
No, I didn't like that.
Just complete ponderous fan service, man.
Well, that carousel scene is a direct reference to one of Ridley Scott's favorite movies, Third Man.
Really?
Yeah.
How so?
Well, there's a scene in the Third Man on a carousel, but I actually thought that it was
a scene on a Ferris wheel.
I mean, Ferris wheel. Sorry.
But there's no Ferris wheel in this. Jacques.
Ferris wheel, carousel, same fucking thing. It's a carnival.
I would have loved it if it was just a series of thriller movies that were like involved different amusement park. Like, it starts with the Ferris wheel, then the carousel, then the bumper cars.
And then they run into what's his name from Face Off on the carousel.
The only thing about this set of scenes I do like was the shot of Lecter against the mirror. I thought that was kind of a nice shot. His face is half there, half not. I thought that was kind of an interesting way of shooting Lecter. But after this, Lecter's captured by Verger's men. And again, I think we're supposed to feel for him. I think we're supposed to hate the fact that he's being captured.
Well, yeah. Such an odious person. I mean, it's kind of stacking the deck, but in a way that is sort of like just naturally built into this kind of narrative where it's like, well, one of them is a serial killer and the other one is also a killer and a child molester. So it's like, well, okay, I guess I know which one I'm supposed to root for, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. This shit, real conflict.
This shit turns into a James Bond movie with the supervillain has him captured and he's like, here's my maniacal plan. You're tied up so you can't get away. It's just, it feels so far removed from the world of what Silence of the Lambs was. I am glad they removed the sister.
Yeah, me too.
Of what happens, but also, I actually have the book in front of me, and I marked something. You were wondering how much more Barney plays into the book.
There's a whole chapter called Barney.
There is a scene where he gets in the shower with Mason's lesbian sister.
And like, the book is dedicated to Barney. Sorry, I just popped being a smart ass.
Awesome. I thought it was funny.
Okay, good. Oh, thank God.
The kind of stuff in this book that you have to wonder, is this a parody? Is it? I mean, I'm glad it's not in the movie, but you're from page to screen, you're like, what is happening?
Well, it's weird. It's weird that you bring that up, because I honestly think after Silence of the Lambs came out, it was such a huge success, and they were bugging Harris to write this novel. And so I think he just flat out said, all right, fuck all you guys. I'll write your book, but I'm just going to completely sabotage every one of these fucking characters, and you're going to hate all of them by the end. You're going to get what you want. I honestly think that's what he did. I think he sabotaged his characters on purpose. I think he sabotaged everything that made Silence of the Lambs work on purpose. And I think you're right. I think he turned it into self-parody. I think he turned it into just something that shouldn't be a serious movie. Let's put it that way. That's just my take on it.
Yeah, there is an element of like, oh, that's, you liked Hannibal Lecter? I'll give you all the fucking I'll give you more Hannibal Lecter than you can fucking stand.
Exactly. On it. We see Lecter, complete with his $250,000 mask on, get real toward his slaughter as Starling interrupts. Lecter tells her it's just like old times, and I'm sitting here thinking, I sure wish that were the case. Man, I wish I was gripped by all this stuff.
She got just wait, you're not Jodie Foster.
Carlo and his men get mangled as Cordell gets coaxed by Lecter to push Verger in. I did like this.
I feel like we're not doing enough justice to the fact that there's human eating pigs in this part. Like, I feel like we're kind of alighting that right now.
Well, I was going to get to that because, Garrett, what you were saying, one of the things I do like about this movie as far as changes go is they give a lot more context to his butler.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he gets, like, abused and he treats him like shit. So when he makes that decision to throw him into the pit, it works. Certainly much better in the book because, Mike, do you know how he dies in the book?
They show this on the TV show, so yeah, I know how.
It's almost exactly how it is on the TV show with the eel and the lesbian sister, because I'm glad they cut this out where the whole reason the sister's there in the book is that because she's a lesbian, she was kicked out of the family, and she wouldn't get any of the inheritance, but Mason doesn't have any children, so her and her lover convict this. See, just saying this shit makes me realize that Harris wrote this.
I remember this story.
So electrocutes him with a cattle prod to get his semen. And in doing so, she shoves an eel down his throat, and that's what kills him.
I think we've all been there.
It's a case of the Mondays.
So Cordell gets coaxed by Lecter to once again push Verger in, which he does as Lecter walks away with Clarice in his arms.
I hate this shot because if you want any proof that Hannibal Lecter is a superhero, the pigs part as he walks out.
Yeah, what was that about? Am I just stupid for not getting that? Or what was going on? Did he coat himself with pig antidote earlier?
Pig antidote.
He built up an immunity to iocane powder. Like, what's going on?
He drank from the fountain and now he's immune to pigs. He has
control. I'm serious.
I have no idea. It's not explained in the movie at all. I don't even know if it's explained in the book. I don't know.
No, it's just, it's just fucking stupid. It's ponderous. It's ponderous and hokey. It's almost ludicrous to say it doesn't fit because this movie is such a tonal mess.
Lecter performs some bizarre surgery on Clarice and he drugs her up. Meanwhile, Krenler shows up just in time to get chloroformed by Lecter, and we are then treated to some even more bizarre developments. Jesus. Now, there are some things I do like, boys. I do like Lecter having a sort of power over Clarice, even if he's drugged her up. It kind of works, like especially like since he shuts her hair in the fridge. Like, her hair is like the thing that defines her femininity, right? So it's putting that in the fridge and kind of keeping her there. I think that was kind of a good bit of symbolism. Very menacing with a knife in his hand. I also like how he knew that she was holding something to bash him over the head with, although it kind of pays off as slapstick, right? Because she keeps grabbing something else. It's just like, it's really weird, but I do like how like he knows.
I think this scene is a really good comparison to climax of Silence of the Lambs, where in Silence, she is trying to get Buffalo Bill and Buffalo Bill shuts off all the lights and she's completely in the dark. She can't see a damn thing. She's completely vulnerable in that sense. She should be completely unmoored and un able to do anything. And we see how, despite that paralysis, she's still able to do what it takes to defeat the bad guy and accomplish what she came out to do. Here, she's also, you know, she's similarly incapacitated here through drugs, and it doesn't feel, as a character, she doesn't nearly have the competence or the capability that she had in that earlier film, and we don't feel the same desire to have her succeed. And that's, I think this is a very good microcosm of why this film doesn't work in the same way that Silence did.
And on that note, though, there's two things I do like about this scene. One of which is the symbolism that ties into Silence of the Lambs, where she is in a position where the killer has power over her and the advantage with the lights in Silence of the Lambs, and the fact that she's on some kind of drug, which is not in the book. I'm kind of glad they made that change, because it plays into what is so egregious about the book, and to a lesser extent in the movie.
I'm not sure whether to take this Crandler stuff, though, this Crandler brain stuff, as camp or just a poorly executed attempt at terror.
Like, I think it's supposed to be both. I think having... I kind of wish that there was more of Ray Liotta with half of his brain cut out and becoming like this even bigger asshole. Like, something about that. Like, I kind of wish he would do a whole movie as that character. Like, not really, but like,
half the time it's not even him, it's an animatronic.
Really?
Yeah, it's actually pretty well done.
They found James Buchanan from the Hall of Presidents, and they were like, this one, I think this is pretty good. It's a pretty good match. And he's got that fucking backwards hat on. Oh, yeah, so good.
But you know what? I don't think Hannibal would cut his own hand off. I don't think he would do that. Like, I don't see anything that this character has been established as doing that. It's just weird that he would cut his own hand off to escape this and not cut hers.
Well, it's better than what's in the book.
Well, yeah, we'll get to the book here in a second. So he escapes the police through the woods, and Moore gets to yell that she's Clarice Starling to the cops or audience, whoever they decide to say it to. We then once again get a final stinger, which is in the middle of the book. I remember this scene from the book, actually. It's a scene I actually really like, as Hannibal shows a little boy a piece of filet, and he declares that he should always try new things as the boy eats.
Eats really out his brain.
Yeah, exactly. Fades around his eye, and the credits roll.
That was silly.
You thought it was silly? I like
fade
that
out
scene.
Over the eye. Oh, that was so.
Oh, that shot. Eyes. Yeah, the final shot.
Oh, the still frame that closes.
Yeah.
I agree. Yeah, I think that's silly, but we're talking about something that happened 5 minutes after someone's brain was eaten.
Yeah, but that's okay. Well, that's diegetically silly. This is a non-diegetic silliness, and I
don't. Don't you mean dietetically silly?
I don't.
Now, Matt, they become lovers in the book, correct?
Yeah, all right. So this is, I think, when Jodie Foster said betrayal of her character, this was like the final blow. So after she gets offered the brain, now keep in mind, in the book, she's not on drugs. By her own free will, she eats the brain. And Hannibal gets in her head that, like, you could replace the sister that I lost in my heart. Because in the book, they mention, this is where they first give his backstory, which is a problem in and of itself, because the more you reveal, the less scary he becomes. That his sister was eaten by Nazi cannibals, which we'll talk about certainly later on down the line.
If there's one thing I hate even more than cannibals, it's Nazi cannibals.
Yeah, Nazi cannibals. It's like, how can we make Nazis even more the symptom of pure evil? Fuck it, right. Cannibals. So then Clarice shows her boobs, puts wine on her nipple, and Lecter tastes it. And then it gets even worse, because it ends with them at an opera, and she's dyed her hair and they're together, and that Hannibal no longer sees his sister. And it just ends with, they say that, like, Clarice, he is happy with Clarice at his side. So that's how the first time I read that, I literally chucked the book across my room. Like, I was that insulted.
I can definitely see where Jodie Foster was coming from. This is a flat out betrayal of the character.
Yeah. And this doesn't even go that far as you're describing, but it still is not.
Mm-hmm.
That was what was so great about her in that first movie, was that she was able to
overcome.
She was able to be vulnerable, to face inner pain and inner darkness and to be at times manipulated. But yeah, at the end was able to overcome it. And I just don't buy that this character would behave or go to the places that she does in this film, let alone what you're describing in this book.
That being said, on a scale of 1 to 10, what do you give Hannibal, Matthew?
Man, for all the stuff that this movie gets wrong, and there's certainly a lot, I do think the Potsy stuff is worthwhile, but you're adapting a book that I detest, and I have to give them credit for trimming as much as they could, but you're left with a finished product that just doesn't work as a cohesive whole. There's everything from character beats that don't work. These people don't feel like the same characters from Silence of the Lambs, even though you have Anthony Hopkins back. It's just, it's a tough movie to recommend, even for the pulp value of certain parts. I would give it, because there are some moments that I do like, some changes that I do like, and the Potsy subplot does warrant some merit. I would give it, to borrow your catchphrase, Garrett, 4 out of 10.
Mike?
I'd say about a 5, in that it's fitfully entertaining. There's nothing that... There's only a few things that really made me roll my eyes or be pissed off or anything like that. But a lot of it is just not there. So yeah, like a 5 out of 10.
5 out of 10. You know, Jodie Foster has said that she was offered more money than she ever made in her career to reprise this role, but she just couldn't see it as herself to take it. And I commend her, because to take this role is to betray that character. Clarice has just no business being in this story. The film, even though I've been tearing it apart, I do think it's infinitely watchable. I do think there are parts that there are hints. Like I said, when he tells Potsy, "I'm going to take great joy of eating your wife." Like, that's the character I loved from that last movie. Like, that's the Anthony Hopkins Lecter. But it just goes into such self-parody. And once this movie leaves Florence and we're strictly in America, the movie becomes a fucking jumbled mess. Just the watchability factor, I'm going to give it a 5. I think it's got enough in it to keep your attention. But I tell you, the end of this movie is just, it's a mess. The movie is a mess. And it reads like bad fan fiction. To take it where Harris took it, how do you go from Silence of the Lambs to this? I have no idea. They did what they could. Zalian did what he could. Scott, I think he just kind of mailed this directing job in. Like you said, Matt, I think, what was the movie he had?
Black Hawk Down.
Yeah, he had Black Hawk Down on his mind. This was the paying gig, and it just doesn't work. But it's still watchable. That's what I hate saying. But yeah, it's 5 out of 10. Now, Mike, when we started this retrospective, you had mentioned the TV show, a Hannibal TV show. You had reviewed episodes of it. You have seen it. And I told you that I would probably try trying it out again, because I tried watching the first episode, turned it off. This week, while I was Christmas shopping, I decided to go ahead and pick the set up. I have the complete series, and I am 6 episodes into the first season.
Nice.
And I texted you a couple times, you know, what I was feeling as I was watching this thing. A couple of the changes, like the Frederica Lowndes character, I think is really, really interesting transition from the book. You know, instead of Freddie Lowndes, I like a lot of what they're doing, and I'm hooked, line, and sinker. And my goal, and this is a pretty big goal, because we only have 2 weeks of these movies left, is to finish this entire series by the end, and I can give a full review of the series. But right now, I'm hooked, line, and sinker, man. It's a good show.
Nice, nice. Have you gotten to? Nah, I don't want to get us too distracted yet, but have you gotten to the Eddie Izzard episodes yet?
I got to one of them. The first Eddie Izzard episode I've gotten to.
Isn't that neat how he's doing, like...
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
For those unaware, he's doing kind of an Anthony Hopkins impression. Yeah. Like the show's version of Hannibal is like a total 180 from Hopkins' interpretation of him. So it's fun to have Eddie Izzard come in for a few episodes as sort of the Hopkins stand-in. It's neat.
It's really neat, yeah. And one thing I noticed that was a change than what I was expecting... I was expecting it to be just a through line, you know. I was expecting it to be just 13 episode remakes of the movies. But it's not, because all 13 episodes actually have different serial killers that they're tracking.
Yes.
That I wasn't expecting.
Yes.
And that threw me for a loop, and in a good way. I really enjoy that aspect of it. It's a infinitely watchable show, and I'm going to give my reviews as we move along.
Yeah. Awesome.
I'm watching it as well, though I'm a little bit further ahead.
Nice. Okay. How far are you?
I just finished the first season.
Oh, isn't that one hell of an ending?
Yeah, I'm super excited, especially I read the what season two borrows, and I'm really excited. Yeah.
All right, I won't give anything away.
Well, we got two reviews in one. This is glorious. Boys, we are three shows down. We have two left of this series. Next week, we're going to see an adaptation / remake of Red Dragon.
And I'm excited to see how they work in that into it, like retrofit it. You heard it here first. I'm excited for a Brett Ratner movie.
That we'll get to next week. Until then, boys, it's been fun. Wish you guys a happy new year. And until next week, ta-ta. Gee, thanks, guys.
You still wake up sometimes, don't you? Wake up in the dark and hear the screaming of the lamb. Do you think if you save poor Catherine, you could make them stop, don't you? You think if Catherine lives, you won't wake up in the dark ever again to that awful screaming of the lamb?
I'll help you catch him, Clary. I do wish we could chat longer, but I'm having an old friend for dinner.
Tell me, Clarice, do you think you'll work as chambermaid at a motel on Route 66, just like your mommy? Huh?
After all, as your mother tells you, and my mother certainly told me, it is important, she always used to say, always to try new things.
You fly back to school now, little starling.
Fly. Wow, brand new headphones. These sound amazing. I recommend anybody getting a pair of Bose headphones. They're pretty fantastic.
You said Bose?
Bose? Is it Bose or Bose?
I think it's Bose.
All right, fine. Bose. Yes. Cheap plug. All right, you ready?
Here, you just felt a lot more kind of schizophrenic. I don't know if I just say that, but...
Starling shoots Esmeralda, and man, does Scott Linger on that slow-mo. Fuck, does he use slow-mo a lot in this scene?
He uses a lot here. It's a very strange choice. And not just slow-mo, but that kind of... that thing where it's like... Damn, this is... I have a master's degree in cinema studies. I should know this, but...
So in the book, there's a lot more context as to how he met Lecter in the first place.
Starling
some
is
of this. Oh, sorry.
Go ahead. How would you feel, Mike, about Tim Roth in the role of Hannibal Lecter? Mike, still there?
Yeah. Sorry, I'm having a hard time hearing you.
Okay. How would you feel about Tim Roth in the role of Hannibal Lecter here?
Can't really hear.
Oh, there you go. You okay now?
No.
God damn it.
Tim Roth?
Yeah, how would you like Tim Roth in this role?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay.
I can hear you.
Okay, all right. Okay, interesting. There was an offer out to Scott Glenn, and he was like, I'm too busy doing Scott Glenn things.
No, I don't think he was written in the original script. I mean, we'll never know because Mamet's script, I don't think we'll ever see the light of day.
I'm literally looking at it right now.
Are you really?
Yeah. Hannibal, screenplay by David Mamet. September 8th, 1999. You just got owned.
You want WikiLeaks?
Interior, midwife's office day. Early rundown office. Fairly rundown office, excuse me. Old and dirty health notices tacked onto bulletin board.
Yeah, it's definitely David Mamet.
Oh, yeah. Meanwhile... Wish you guys a happy new year, and till next week, ta-ta, gee. Thanks, guys. All right, boys. I get to start my marathon editing tomorrow, so I hate both of you.
Why did you say that name?
You've been listening to the Binge Media Podcast Network on BingeMedia.net. Subscribe to us on iTunes. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook. Buy some merch at BingeMedia.net/shop. Subscribe to our newsletter at BingeMedia.net/newsletter. And don't forget,
I can't get enough of soup.
Bob Odenkirk.